Okay, today we're going to be talking about being neurodivergent in the workplace. We're going to have more than one episode on this, so it'll be coming in many parts. We don't know how many parts it will be, because we're just going to make up as we go along. But the point being is this. There's going to be a few questions that we want to discuss. The first of the questions is, has anyone come out as neurodivergent in their workplace? And how did co-worker perceptions of you change? Was the overall experience a positive or negative one? If the experience was negative, did you regret disclosure? This episode, I'm going to be asking you your experiences, and you can cover more than one job. It's obviously, you haven't just done one job, so therefore there's plenty of opportunity to discuss situations and even the ones where you didn't disclose it in the early days when you weren't aware of who you were, that kind of thing. Just your general experiences of being different in the workplace.
Okay, so where do you want me to start?
Wherever you want.
The first one, I can't remember the questions. How terrible is that? So did I come out as neurodivergent? Well, obviously, I didn't know until my probably late 20s that I even was on the spectrum. And obviously now we've embraced the term neurodivergent because we've realized that there is more to our story than just autism. It's, you know, we're kind of a bit of everything on the comorbidity flower. So for us, we now feel that the term neurodivergent is just more fitting to us and our children. I always knew I was different, and in every workplace, even before realizing I was autistic and certainly before diagnosis, my work history has been really difficult. And the most notable thing was my lack of desire to socialize with colleagues.
How did that come across to your co-workers?
I was often criticized or made to feel as though I just didn't care about people. I didn't care about them. I didn't make an effort. And that made me quite alienated at work. So that then led to me doing things like going out with them, even when I didn't want to. And, you know, just to fit in. But even then, I still didn't really fit in because I still wasn't doing the things they did. Like, for example, I wouldn't drink loads, or, you know, I'm not saying that that hasn't ever happened. When I was young, I did. We can talk about that another time. But there were just other things that I would rather be doing than going out and drinking. And actually, the anxiety of getting ready and going out and socializing was just so prominent, if that's the right word, that it was just a really difficult thing for me to actually put myself out there to do. But I had to, had no choice. I learned very quickly that if you didn't socialize with people outside of the workplace, that you would be ostracized. And so that was my experience. But as I said, then I would go out with them, and that would also be a failure because I still didn't interact the way that they expected me to. And I'd go home early because I'd get overwhelmed with the noise and the music. And, you know, it's just really bizarre how I could go out and not even drink, and yet I'd feel really hungover, and it didn't make any sense. And then people would mock me for that kind of thing. And, you know, to be honest, the best part of the evening for me was if I got to go and have a bit, you know, a takeaway afterwards or something, and pick up a burger and some chips and go home. But it didn't matter what time I went home. And we've talked about this even now. I needed to have time to decompress. Even if I got home at 11 o'clock or midnight, I would still need a good hour or so to decompress, and to now what I know is to kind of calm my senses down, really, and to realign everything. Because those experiences were bad. So, you know, I suppose that's a long-winded answer to it. But yeah, the early experiences, even before we knew who I was and why I was struggling with these areas, was not a positive one for me. And that's every workplace socially. I had to force myself to participate in activities that I didn't want to, but there was never any acceptance or understanding for me not wanting to do them.
Yeah, I'd agree with you. The culture seems to be you have to slot in 100% to what your co-workers are into. And if you deviate from that at all, then you're outside of the circle. And sometimes that will affect opportunities as a result. I knew some people would make a lot of their decisions when they were smoking. So,
oh my God, I was just going to say, do you remember the Friends episode?
Yes.
Of Rachel.
It's true.
And she doesn't smoke, so she's not in the club.
Exactly.
And decisions get made at fag break, you know.
Yeah.
I was actually just thinking about that. And you know, I agree with you because I've seen that actually happen. Like, come on, bud, let's go and have a smoke. And then, but these people bond.
They do.
Over these things.
I used to go with a coworker on his cigarette break just because it was to get out of the office. And a lot of the time you'd find out more of the information or what's really going down or the truth. And it's quite amusing because you've got essentially what is the shop floor, even though it's not really a shop, but that's just a figure of speech. And it's like outside that environment, right, here's how it really is kind of thing. And then you get the inside information and how you need to play something. And then you're like, okay, cool. Thanks for briefing me on this. So it was those opportunities that was the result of the smoking break.
Yeah, so you've got the networking, and I missed out on a lot of that because I literally didn't really take breaks. there was some time, you know, I can't say there weren't any people I liked socialising with, and it wasn't even that I disliked the co-workers.
No.
It was just, this is not something I enjoy doing, and no one could ever accept that. And you get teased, especially in my first workplace, which was a bank, and I was about probably 17, 18 there. So they found that very odd. That I didn't want to do these things.
Because you're not a carbon copy of everyone else.
Yeah. But, you know, like I said, I did force myself into a lot of situations. But they were always really bad situations. And you'd end up failing in them and embarrassing yourself. And then actually everybody the next day would feel so connected from having this lovely social time together. And I'd go in feeling even more awkward. So.
Yeah. No, I know.
And judged. It's bizarre. I was always like the sensible, boring,
straight-laced person who never let their hair down properly.
On occasion I did, but generally speaking I was there out of, is it duty? I don't know what the word would be, and I wasn't there really to enjoy the experience. I didn't really want to be there, so you know, I could fake it for so long, but there's only so long you can actually keep that mask on, and it was always clear that I just was uncomfortable.
That was quite amusing, as I felt the same way. But I just went about it a completely different way. It tended to be, okay, to fit in, I need to basically get shit-faced.
I remember.
And which had its own problems as a result.
And then that used to drive me mad because I was like, why do you, you know, you'll say, oh, I'm only having a couple of drinks, and then you would get absolutely bladdered.
Yeah.
And I would be so angry with you saying, you know, because I'm not saying I've been perfect. I haven't. We can talk about that, like I said, another time. But it used to really frustrate me because you would have the intention of one thing, but then you always do another.
Yeah.
And you've told me it's to fit in.
Part of it's fitting in. Part of it's, well, when the alcohol starts flowing, it obviously impairs your judgment. And then before you know it, you've gone with the flow so much that you're actually
enjoying
off your
it.
Face.
You're deemed as more cool because you do it, you know. Doing what everybody else is doing, and it's really tough.
Yeah, exactly. That's the thing. I was able to wear a few masks. I used to do that more in school, but we won't go into school. That's a different one.
I have to just interject here with, my family have often said about you that you are like a different person around different people, and I used to be so offended by that, but then I've seen it over the years myself more. You morph into whoever you're around, and some people see that as a dishonest part of you, like it's, you're not really you. But actually I think it is more to do with the fact that you can't be yourself.
No,
I can't
cannot.
Be myself, so you kind of have to either,
it's a survival mechanism,
you do
it's
what I've done
what
and
I
you
do.
Be yourself and get rejected, which is what I'm going through an awful lot at the moment of looping on this stuff, or you do what you do and you just keep masking just to keep things ticking over. I think as a man it is a bit easier for you in ways.
It is easier. Also, I ended up working in IT, which is quite easy to fit in and be a certain personality.
And I was expected to go and gossip, and it's just not my thing.
And do all the bitchy stuff.
Even in the staff room, and I've talked about this before, but I will mention it again, in the staff room when I was teaching, you know, I'm not saying it's every school, but you do tend to get the gossip in there. And I didn't have any respect for our deputy head at all. Really incompetent member of staff. And, you know, that's just a fact on a professional level. But when we were in the staff room one day, the other staff were criticising her physical appearance, and I had no interest in participating in that. And, you know, they were like, I don't know, that also alienated me because I wasn't joining in. It alienated me because they then think that I'm then judging them, or that I might go and tell someone.
Yeah.
And I had to make it clear that actually it's literally nothing more than I have no interest in small talk. If they'd have said something, you know, if they'd have asked me outright what my opinion was on her as a professional, I'd have openly shared that, you know, because I'm quite honest. But I'm just not interested in all of that, you know, being nasty about people and gossiping. It's just not my style.
You're not there to attack physical attributes or any of that stuff.
Well, I just think that's mean.
Yeah, just
personally.
It's weird, their whole culture, because a lot of it's to your face, they'll say one thing, and behind your back, it's like, oh, this knife is yours. And I've never understood that. I'd rather be straight talking.
But you know what? Despite all of the years that I have witnessed people exhibiting this behaviour, and considering I'm so pattern-based, it has taken me to my 30s to realise that that is actually what they were doing about me as well.
That's the other thing, because early days you can be naive when people will come to you and they'll be kind of very forthright or volunteering information or an opinion about someone else. And it's almost like, what are they doing that for? You first you think, oh, okay, they feel like they can confide in me. And
yeah,
it's almost like a trap, because in many ways you're like, do they want you to kind of confirm what they're thinking and kind of mirror that back and go, yeah, I agree with you, which is kind of not good, because obviously...
I've had a lot of people put words in my mouth.
Yes.
I've been used as a scapegoat a lot.
Yes, I bear witness to that. I was there that night from one of the main ones.
And, you know, so just going back to the original thing, the question about divulging. Obviously, I didn't, because I didn't know, but I knew there was something not quite the same about me, and everybody knew it. But that just got shaken off as I was boring and weird, really, which is nice. And then time went on, I had different jobs, and actually the job that I felt the most accepted in was when I was working in retail. And I worked in a curtain shop, which I wound up feeling really a part of the team there. I felt important, I felt liked and appreciated.
Feeling valued is important.
And it was. When I went to the bank, it was horrendous. We'll talk about that entire experience another time.
That deserves one whole episode.
It really does. That was horrendous. And then when I was studying, I did care work, which again, I really enjoyed, and I felt appreciated there by the clients, not necessarily the agency. But then I ended up back in retail. And I have to say, that was probably the nicest team of people I've ever worked with. I just really enjoyed it there. They were nice people. I felt part of the team. And they knew, again, I was still me and a little bit quirky. And I'm not saying all staff members got me, but my little team did. And actually, I suspect a couple of those. I don't know if you remember my manager.
Yes.
I suspect she might have been on the spectrum. But again, I didn't know I was at the time. So it's really interesting. But now looking back, I can see a couple of those people that I worked with were very aligned with me.
Yeah.
So it was really nice, actually. I felt accepted there. And yet people mock those kinds of jobs. And I can see why people, you know, apparently it's quite common for people on the spectrum to settle into jobs like that. And people say, oh, you know, it's because they don't have the ability for more. And I think it's nothing more than it's the comfort, the predictability, the familiarity. Because, it's a tricky world out there for us, for people like us. And we'll come to this as well. But, you know, people do think that there's something wrong with you, and it's just horrendous. So it's really important to find people you can be yourself around. And I'm currently trying to find my own group of people, because I haven't had that, really. I've had a few people down the line who've been amazing, but generally speaking, in every social setting I've been in, so in every, like, you know, college, university, every workplace, it starts off brilliantly, it ends up very sour, and I'm always the one who's left out, and I'm the one who they all talk about, and I'm the one who, for some reason, there's like a negative vibe against.
Yeah.
And I get used and I get abused and bullied, and these things consistently happen, and I end up alone and feeling very rejected. And yet you just can't understand why, because I'm a really nice person and I'm very professional, but, you know, it's tricky.
It's an interesting one, because I was there at the bank at the same time that you were at the bank. That'd be a good one to start off with, really. You didn't disclose back then. You didn't know anything about yourself then.
But can I be honest, if I'd known back then, I probably wouldn't have told them. They were not the most pleasant people. They were very oppressive.
Yes,
it was. Very judgmental and weaponized. A very dishonest group of people. It was dog eat dog.
It was terrible as well when you think of the level of pettiness and backstabbing that went on
it
there.
It was awful. That was I think that's probably the worst place I've ever worked.
And for what little pay as well.
Yeah, it was horrendous. Again, that needs its own discussion. But regarding disclosing, so I'm so sorry, because I know I've really waffled.
No, not at all. I want to give an example of experiences in the workplace.
Yeah.
And that was one of the things.
Well, I didn't know I was. I would have probably disclosed it to some of the workplaces and not others. I think there are still some where I would have maybe still been smart enough to have thought no. But then saying that, I'm very naive and I'll give you the experience that happened when I did find out. So I was working at a school. I'd had all these failed interactions at, different workplaces. And like I said, I've met lovely people, but I've also met a lot of people who've really taken advantage of me. And everyone always says, but you're an intelligent person. So how do you let this happen? And I can't ever answer the question. To this day, I don't really fully understand why I keep allowing the same things to happen over and over again, because I'm a pattern seeker almost. But I think there are a lot of things in communication outside of our neurodivergent world that I'm never going to fully grasp. I've managed to understand some of it, but I'm never going to fully grasp it.
It's the invisible stuff.
Yeah.
The unwritten rules.
And I'm so honest. Like, if I'm asked a direct question, I'll answer it directly. That's not what people want to hear.
We're not here to lie to you. If you want an opinion, we will give you
an honest one.
Yes.
And I have learnt, of course, over the years that sometimes it's not in your favour too. So I'm not completely daft. But generally speaking, there is this part of me where even if there's a part of me inside saying, don't say it, it's going to cause trouble. I can't help it, because it's the truth. And I'm like a truth seeker. And I lose control.
You can't handle the truth.
It's bizarre. I can't help sometimes what comes out, and I regret it afterwards deeply.
Some of it, I swear, it's like, please, I've just come to you. I'm asking a rhetorical question. Just lie to me back, just to satisfy my ego or something. Sometimes I just don't get what they want from you. Because originally you just take everything literally and you're like, okay, you're asking me a question. You honestly want my opinion.
Absolutely. And it is that literal. Going back to the school thing, I think we were talking about this recently. I really upset my head teacher.
Yes.
And assistant head teacher, because I was the literacy coordinator of a school and they hadn't actually paid me TLR. And they said, oh, it will come.
This is good.
And the maths coordinator said, it did take a few months for mine to come in, but it will come. Don't worry. And this is just, I'd just been reading about responsibilities in school, because I'm obsessive about everything that I embark upon. And at that point, obviously, I was a teacher. So I read everything that there was about education. And that went from obviously the teaching part to a lot of other needs that children and might have, up to management level. It was just, people used to think that was so odd, but I couldn't help it. If there was a piece of literature out there that I got my hands on, then I would read it, because I found it fascinating. And in my early career, my intention was to become a head teacher. And that was partly because my granddad told me that we had a lot of headmistresses in our family historically, as well as education inspectors. So I kind of just wanted to follow in their footsteps, if that makes any sense. So to me, that was kind of the natural path I was going on. So I've always thought, it doesn't hurt to read this stuff and educate myself and know what I'm actually getting myself into, because that's where I wanted to go. And I wanted to see, it doesn't hurt to find out what you're going to get into in, what's in store for you. So we're in this meeting, and the head teacher, we had an Ofsted visit due any time. As it happens, they didn't come while I was there. But they said, what are you going to say about this and that? And the frustration for me was, although I did do a good job there, they took me into their school to promote a particular type of learning that I had implemented elsewhere. And then they decided not to do it. So, of course, my baby was this thing that I was going to implement and get going in this school to improve everything. And they then pulled it and said, oh, you're not doing that now. And it kind of left me with no project. Now, obviously, there were a lot of things I could do. And I implemented a SPAG program. And, you know, obviously, as and guided reading had to become a priority. So it's not like I did nothing in that time. But the thing that I went in there to specifically improve was pulled away. And I was a little bit upset about it.
Especially when you can see the value in what you're delivering.
Because it had been proven, the results, time and time again elsewhere.
It's working right now of our own children.
Exactly, you know, but again, that's another story. So, but this head teacher then said in this meeting, what are you going to say you've done? And she was trying to prep me because she was worried about, you know, me selling it well, I suppose, with the inspector. But when she said, you know, because this responsibility falls on you at the end of the day, and I just factually said back, well, actually, no, I don't think that's true. From what I've read, because you don't pay me a TLR, a teaching and learning responsibility, it actually doesn't fall on my shoulders. It will fall on yours. And they were really, I mean, I'm not saying obviously I wouldn't be accountable on some level because I'm in that role, but I wasn't being paid for the responsibility. So therefore, actually, I'm not accountable. I'm not being given any perks for doing that position. And ultimately, it would have fallen back on them. And she was so angry with me. And I even had an email from her afterwards saying it was a very odd thing for me to say. Was I making a hint? Was I making a point? And it was nothing more than just in that moment, she said something that was factually inaccurate and I was compelled to correct her. And that's my whole life right there.
Hate it. 99.9% of people hate it when they get corrected. But the thing is, they shouldn't open themselves up to that in the first place.
I think it's also
misinformation.
Yeah. But I think it's also, you know, the frustration for me is this. This is the workplace I did disclose that I was autistic. This is the place where I found out I was and went through a bit of a grieving period and decided I wanted to tell them because very naively, I was going through a lot and I thought, right, they need to know that I'm not kind of functioning the same way as I normally would be because this is a huge thing to take in.
Yes.
Revisiting your whole life and realizing why all these things have failed for you. And, you know, up until this point, you just think there's something wrong with you and you must be this awful person. And so I disclosed to this workplace that I was expecting very naively that they would, as teachers who work with children, many of whom have special needs, they would have some kind of understanding and empathy for me. And if anything, it just turned them against me and they used it against me.
Yep.
And it was a really, again, I can elaborate in another recording, but it was not a nice experience and things spiraled from that day onwards. And by the point that we got to the TLR meeting, actually, I'd already told them that I was who I was, that I was going through diagnosis. I forwarded things for them to read. I know that not everybody's going to necessarily understand and grasp everything because it's an enormous thing to get your head around. But there were certain no-nos in working with autistic people. You know, there were certain things that should be avoided and they didn't avoid them, even though I'd actually forwarded things that would help me in the workplace and things that weren't working for me. It just never changed because they didn't see it as their place to have to adapt. It was my place to adapt.
Which, to be honest, is discrimination because technically it's a disability, even though I don't disabled. No. Only by the environment.
Yeah, well that's the thing, isn't it? You know, and there's certain things you can't change, but yeah. This particular thing is actually from the book Asperger's on the Job, which I forwarded to them, and it was about not surrounding, I believe, again it's been a long time since I've read it, but not surrounding the autistic person and making them feel kind of trapped. I mean, you wouldn't do it to a child, and you know, that's what they used to do. It used to feel like a gang up sometimes and they would corner me and have me trapped.
Physically.
And then I would be very overwhelmed and I wouldn't be myself. I wouldn't be able to function in a way, you know, and people can say, well, then, you know, that does make you less than or disordered. But I don't think it does. You know, I think if we're struggling with a certain environment or a certain way of being spoken to or treated, then I think there's nothing wrong with saying, this makes me uncomfortable. It's like saying, oh, that light's very bright, could we turn it down, please? And someone saying, no, deal with it.
Well,
it's ridiculous.
I don't want to use the wheelchair analogy. But
I've heard this one.
Again, it's like, for example, oh, okay, well, we need to give you a ramp so you can get access to the building. Well, okay, they'll accommodate that, but they won't accommodate a small request, as you just mentioned there.
No, and it's just silly things. And like I said, for the TLR comment in particular, she already knew at this stage that I was autistic. So if they have any understanding of autism, which they believed they did, but they I didn't. Then on reflection realised it was all media representations, stereotypes. And stereotypes. And that was where a lot of the problems came in, because they started to question me a lot and think I was somehow intellectually disabled. Even though I'd been teaching all these years and was doing a really good job at the school, all of a sudden you get seen differently. And that was the most notable thing for me. I started being spoken to differently, treated differently, and really patronized, you know, condescended, accused of all sorts of things, accused of not, you know, perceiving things correctly. When actually, by this point, I think I was about 30, 31.
Yeah.
And it really wasn't the same level of issue at that stage. And I think I said to them, if I was a 10-year-old girl, I'd understand, but I'm in my 30s. It's not quite the same. I've learned a lot of techniques. I've learned a lot in that time.
We've played the adult game long enough.
Yeah. And again, I've openly admitted I still have some social issues, but actually I think it's more to do with the double empathy problem, which is another discussion. I don't think it's actually because there's anything wrong with me or anything wrong with the neurotypical mind either. I think it's the fact that the two minds just do not interact naturally very well, because we just are so different in the way we approach and interact with the world. But instead I got made to feel like there was something wrong with me, and people took, you know, well, wasted no time in kind of laying the boot in, really. It was absolutely horrendous. And for that TLR conversation to then question my motives, there were no motives at all. But that is what people always put on whatever you say, they add extra layers and motives to it. And there was nothing more than that. And if they understood autism and how you are quite blunt and honest, then they wouldn't maybe have been so offended.
Well, this is the thing, a lot of their hang-ups are over there and shortcomings in their ego. The other issue you have there is, if you rewind a minute or two, is the fact that you've essentially just confessed that essentially you've suffered discrimination in the workplace, especially after you've actually disclosed that you're on the spectrum. That cannot be stated enough, because you just said beforehand you weren't being questioned. But the minute you drop the A word into the equation, you're being second-guessed and you're suddenly less than.
Yeah. And again, I have talked about this before, but there will be some repeated content and I'll probably repeat it again because it is relevant. But one of the things was, we were discussing Michael Gove in the staff room and none of the teachers were big fans of him. I don't think you'll find many teachers are, particularly at that time, because it was when he was introducing the new curriculum. And no one is debating that there are some good parts to it, but he wasn't creating this curriculum really for the good of the children. I think it was just to leave his mark, like he did with the academies. Again, another discussion.
Oh, he left his mark.
Oh, yeah. We will discuss that another time.
I've left marks before when I've urinated against a wall.
Lovely. Yeah, it's very similar in standard to that really. But, you know, we weren't happy. He was really promoting a lot of us as dead wood and the ones that don't like things will, you know, the dead wood will leave. And actually, he was actually bullying and encouraging really good teachers to leave the profession because we just didn't agree with the changes and the way the children were being made to feel. And anyway, again, another story. But the point is, we were having this discussion about the changes and about him in the staff room. I did not start the discussion. I think you know where this is going. Somebody else started the discussion. There were some NQTs present. One of them was older than me. She was in her 50s, I believe. 40s, 50s? Can't remember fully. But anyway, we were all having this discussion. But I do not know to this day who actually officially complained. But I have my suspicions. it's out of two people, but I think I know who it is. And another colleague said they believe it's this person as well, but that's fine. But this person really had an issue with me anyway when I came out as autistic. And I said, oh gosh, it feels really nice to be able to drop the mask. And I meant, you know, being able to say, this is who I am. Now I don't have to feel like I need to go and socialize, because very naively, I thought they would accept, oh, she's autistic. Oh, we won't force her to come out with us then. Sadly, that still wasn't the case. You are still seen as being just unsociable and uncaring. But this woman said to me, do you know, I knew it was all an act. And it really upset me. I said, what's an act? She said, well, you're teaching and all that kind of thing. I knew that wasn't real, because I'd led some staff meetings and I'm very energetic and eccentric. And when I did the staff meetings to the adults, I kind of did it as though we were doing a lesson for the children, because I was modelling things. And one of my colleagues actually said, gosh, were you born to just teach? You know, and it was just, you know, I don't think you were born to do anything else other than teach. And I was like, oh, thank you so much. And they all thought really highly of me, but she clearly didn't like it, but said nothing. And then when I came out as autistic, that was the comment. Oh, I knew it was all an act. As though she was just so happy that it was all not real. And I still know the teaching part, that's me. Me in that classroom, that's me. I said, you know, the mask is the coming down to the staff room for 10 minutes to not offend my co-workers. It's that kind of thing.
Yes.
It was more feeling like, oh gosh, I've got to try and make an effort. And I felt naively like I'd be able to just relax a bit and be myself, but that also was not the case. But this individual anyway, we're having this conversation about Michael Gove, and as I said, I did not start it. I was not the only person involved in this discussion. But in my PPA time, which is when you go and plan and assess and that kind of thing, the head teacher came in to see me and said there'd been a complaint about me being negative in the classroom, in the staff room, sorry. And I queried it, because I'm not a negative person. I'm very factual. And I will have factual discussions. I have very serious discussions. But I just was not negative. If you asked anybody, I was always smiling. And I was actually really happy in that environment in terms of with the children and the actual job. Not necessarily the other staff all the time, but I felt at home there with my class. And I just loved that career. I just loved education. And she then said, you know, well, that's how it's been perceived by other people, that you're being negative in front of NQTs, again, who were involved in the discussion, who are grown adults, one of whom was older than me. And then I got asked if maybe my perceptions were skewed and I didn't perceive myself as being negative because I'm autistic. And it was that bit for me that I said, look, that's when I made the comment about, you know, if I was a 10-year-old girl, maybe, but I'm actually a woman in my 30s. And believe me, we were all involved in that discussion. I did nothing wrong. Have you spoken to anybody else about this? No, because I'm the autistic. So I'm the one who's wrong. I'm the one who's gauged it incorrectly. And she left and I cried. I literally put my face onto the desk and just cried. And then I saw her out the corner of my eye look through a window and she looked satisfied. But that was the reaction. And that is that was the remaining months of my time there. That was what my experience was like.
That's basically discrimination and bullying in the workplace.
But they don't see it as that. They see it as I was the one being difficult and you know, and they actually put a poster up in the staff room saying something like, you know, negativity needs oxygen to breathe. Don't give it the oxygen or something. And that was one of the other staff members, the one I believe is the one who complained, said, well, that's definitely about you.
And I'd also argue that toxic positivity will also poison everyone.
I hate toxic positivity. I can't bear it. It's just so artificial. Oh, what will be. No, do you know what? I understand sometimes people want to make you feel better. And there have been times I've done it myself. You know, there'll be something around the corner, that kind of thing. That's more trying to be optimistic and positive. But when you dismiss somebody by going, oh, well, what will be, that's toxic.
You're trying to silence them.
And dismiss them. So that's toxic positivity, because you're using apparent positivity to put somebody down, and that's not kind and that's not empathetic.
And it's also done in a way that means that there's no comeback on the person doing it either, because try
just
doing
being
that.
Optimistic. Yeah, that's what they
you
do.
You can hide behind that, because
I like to just be an optimistic person, you know, glass half full and all that. Mm.
They're the type of people that they really grind my gears, and I would not piss on them if they were on fire. those people repulse me.
Were there any other questions that you wanted answered? I think I've answered many of them in a really long-winded, waffly, disjointed way.
I think you've covered most of it, but what I will end on is your advice to other people about disclosure in the workplace.
It is a really difficult thing to... I would say you gauge how comfortable you feel in that environment. But the problem there is that, you know, as a neurodivergent individual, I obviously felt safe to disclose it there. I thought it was going to bring me understanding that I hadn't had previously. And actually it wound up making everything get a lot worse for me. So I don't know what the answer is.
I struggle with that question myself. I think that's what's powerful about that question. I compare it to this. There's a book called The Art of War by Sun Tzu. It was originally written a long, long, long time ago by a Chinese general, and it is popular in the business world, and there was a particular saying in it which rings true. If you know yourself and know your enemy in 1,000 battles, you will be victorious. Now, how I translate that into this equation is the following. Because we know we are neurodivergent and we know the neurotypical environment and what we're dealing with, aka the enemy in this instance is them as their opposition. Sometimes it's better just to keep it to yourself, and as long as you're getting on and no one's questioning you.
So only disclose if it's to get some kind of support that you need.
I would probably argue if you're doing your job well, not being questioned or undermined, then as you were.
But isn't that so sad? Because really, you know, we are here trying to promote awareness and acceptance.
Yes.
And yet we're then saying, but at the same time, like, just don't rock the boat. Don't make things hard for yourself. No. I'm slightly of the opposition. I know that disclosing made my life harder, but I'm still glad I did it. Because hopefully they might just think twice when they come across the next person. You never know. Or it might have created some kind of issue for them that if they find out somebody is, they just won't employ them. You know, I don't know. I don't know.
It's a really difficult one. It's like you have to stay closeted or something. And it's so weird because you can't really be yourself. But then again, you could argue when you're in the workplace, you are, you know, you're putting on your business head. You have to act according and act a certain way.
Yeah, so you're kind of masking to a point regardless.
So in many ways, it's just, you know, it's just part of it.
But at the same time, and this is where I do believe I'm PDA, I have PDA even, I do believe it to a point. I didn't before, but we've gone over a lot of examples, which again would be another discussion of where, that ticks the box, that ticks the box. There is a part of me that I do not appreciate being silenced and being made to feel like I must be silenced. And that is where I get myself into trouble, because actually I have every right to disclose it. And they do have a responsibility to educate themselves, but they don't. And I think this is the problem. You are the one who is disordered. You are the one who is wrong. You are the one who is different. It's very sad.
Well, here's the other thing. I found most of the time, if this a particular thing that I need accommodating, because I haven't obviously disclosed my neurological condition, in quotation, a lot of times it's a case of a request and going, can I have this or I don't like that or whatever. So it's more of a, you haven't attached your label over it. It's just a case of, on a personal level, I don't like that. You know, what are the chances? So it seems like people naturally want to kind of accommodate you anyway, most of the time.
Oh, do they?
In some environments, I will add. So
you can get away with it where you were. Like, for example, you can wear headphones all day, but when I was teaching, that wasn't possible. And I will admit, I used to have sensory overload in the classroom. Somebody's asked me, in fact, when I was going for my diagnosis, that was one of the things I was asked. How did you teach with, you know, being autistic? Well, I was actually a really good teacher. But yeah, there were elements of my day, even before diagnosis, before knowing I was, that I struggled with. And I'd get very heightened with the auditory issues, if you can. And I'd come down on the kids quite hard on that. And now I can see why, because to a lot of other teachers, it was probably nothing. But to me, it was, a cacophony. And I was like, right, come on, guys, you know, I can't explain it. It's just really, there were definitely things. I remember the last classroom I worked in had the brightest lights, and we, and it was also really hot. And can I tell you another thing, actually? I got myself into trouble doing this. So it was really, really hot. And I mean, it was, there had been something wrong. It was a new building and they needed to change something in the tiles or something. It was retaining heat. You probably remember because you visited. And the temperature went to a level that was apparently so high that you should actually send people home if it gets to that level. But I can't remember what it is. Like, legally, you could say that it's not safe to work, to be here. But me and my naivety saw this as a learning opportunity, and we had thermometers around and all that kind of thing, and we were measuring the temperature and we were doing like bar charts and things like that. And then of course the children were going home and telling their parents, then we had loads of complaints, and I got told I was doing that on purpose as well. They actually perceived that I was somehow they thought I was being really passive aggressive, and that I was, how dare you, that I've had loads of complaints. And
so you should.
But then I was like, I just don't see what I've done wrong. But actually the parents do have a right to complain, but she's saying if you hadn't brought their attention to it. And, you know, but we did have a thermometer in the classroom anyway that the children were reading. And I thought, oh, they're reading the thermometer. They're interested. They're interested because they're burning.
Yes.
They're burning up. They're like, whoa, what's the temperature? Yeah. I took them out as much as possible and we sat and did work under the trees on the field. But you can't do that every single day. But it was horrendous.
I love the fact that they're holding you accountable for the fact that they violated their own health and safety.
But this workplace, basically, that's what happened for months.
They're an absolute shit show.
There's so much more I could tell you. And what is a real shame is I was drawn to this school because it was painted as so flexible and free and child-focused. And the longer I worked there, I realised that it wasn't what it was cracked up to be. And it is a real shame. It was the last school that I worked in because it has kind of like traumatized me a little bit. And like the last couple of weeks, I've cried an awful lot and it's been reliving a lot of these things. And about the rejection, really, as an individual that I've had from every workplace. And I do see that a lot of it is just miscommunication, people creating ideas about you that are inaccurate, but in their minds as neurotypicals, your behavior means something that it doesn't. So they've read things into what you've said and done that you know, were not intentional. And they can still say, well, you're at fault for doing that, but it was never an intentional thing. So it's really, and again, it's the double empathy thing. I'm not going to blame them entirely, but I don't feel that I should be blamed either. I think it's just us not understanding one another. But when you do come out as autistic, they are the majority. So I don't think it hurts for them to think, right, well, let's see if we can put ourselves in her shoes and see how it must have felt.
They never do, though.
But they don't. It's your responsibility to change yourself. But you spend your whole life masking and it creates trauma. And that is kind of what I feel I'm getting the effects of now, actually.
Yeah. The other thing I would say is reputations, they take a lifetime to build, but only seconds to destroy.
Yeah.
So you can start off in a job, you do well, and like you said, you've experienced some issues. And then the next thing you know, everything you worked hard for gets destroyed. So the other important thing is to have an exit strategy in place. Line something up.
Well, I got pregnant.
That was a good strategy.
It was. We were going to hold off having a family, but I was so miserable there that we decided to start it a year earlier.
We went for a walk down the beach to discuss it.
Yep. Where all the big decisions used to be made before COVID. And yeah. But it's, I don't know. I like to be really positive about, you know, autism, neurodivergence. I do not think it's this negative thing that everybody goes on about, but sadly you do have to acknowledge that there are challenges, and every individual is, I don't like the word affected, but let's just say affected differently with overlaps. And I make a point of that all the time because my experience is not going to be everybody else's experience. Some people will have a more positive one and some will have a more negative one. We're not all the exact same, but it does come with its challenges. I do want to celebrate parts of it as well, but in the workplace my personal experience has not been positive, and a lot of the people I've spoken to, mainly women, funnily enough, have had really negative experiences too, which is something we can explore further another time.
Definitely, because I think there's a combination of the gender affecting your experience, because obviously you're...
And the type of jobs we go into, because autistic women, contrary to what people believe, are very empathetic. And again, I know this will cause problems because there are men who are as well, and then they say you shouldn't be just saying it's this gender, and obviously then you've got different pronouns. I'm not very knowledgeable about a lot of this at the moment. I'm trying to learn, so I don't want to cause offence to anybody. No. So at the moment, I'm just going to say female autistics, but I do appreciate it's not, you know, completely easy to categorise in that way. But generally speaking, people like myself are very empathetic, despite being told that we can't possibly be, and we go into very caring roles. And apparently a lot of female autistics tend to go into things like nursing and caring and teaching. You know, I know a lot of women who are on the spectrum and they're occupational therapists, and you know, we're all kind of in these roles that are very influential, very professional, very successful, but we've all had similar experiences where it doesn't matter how well you perform professionally, because of the social issues, you're left with trauma. That is the only way I can explain it. You're bullied and you're traumatized. And a lot of us have actually stepped outside of work. We've stepped outside of employment because this or tried to find self-employment opportunities to just not have to be around that other people.
A lot of people end up deciding the only way to make their way in the workplace is essentially to be your own boss or to do freelancing or...
But isn't that sad, really?
I can see the advantages of basically taking the bull by the horns.
But not everybody has the opportunity to do that.
True. And there are many people that will be consigned to the scrap heap. It's not a good situation to be in.
I'm always aware of making it sound like them and us, neurotypical, neurodivergent. I don't think anything is that binary. I said to you the other day, they're both a spectrum. People don't view it that way, but they are. Autistic people... There is a spectrum of categories of people within that spectrum. We're not all the same. And the same goes for the mirror image, the flip side, which is the neurotypical side. You know, they're not all the same either. You cannot put anybody into a box.
Even though I will say the MRI scans would say that the neurotypical wiring is pretty much carbon.
True. But yeah.
From a personality perspective.
It's that. That's what I mean. You know, again, I think what my point is, just because you're neurotypical doesn't mean you're empathetic.
Yes.
You know, we've all got different skill sets and we're all different. And not every autistic person is empathetic and not every neurotypical is either. I've come across very many who think they are, but they're not. They think what they perceive as empathy to me is cold and uncaring because it's conditional. It is only available for certain people or certain situations. And we could go into that completely on another discussion.
Another one.
But, you know, whereas I'm empathetic, I will put myself in people's shoes, even if it hasn't affected me personally and it has nothing to do with my life. No matter how politically, you know, I'm aligned, I can still put myself in someone's shoes and have empathy for them. And actually, this is another area that we do need to discuss on another one, is how... That's another reason why you do get bullied so much. Because I've always empathised with the bully. It's ironic, but it's true. You know, you don't fully understand. And then someone explains it, my mum, you know, like, oh, it's because of, you know, they think about their home life or they've got problems or their upbringing or, you know, you're like, oh gosh, yeah, I feel so bad for them. You know, while they're calling you names and following you to and from school and making your life a misery and threatening to punch you every 5 seconds and... You know,
yeah, your approach tricky. Is completely different to my approach.
Yeah,
mine was to basically seek out their destruction and then understand them after they are no longer a threat to me.
Yeah, but I think it's this. You know, I think that is another discussion entirely. But
oh yeah, that's good.
There's definitely double empathy issues at play. I believe in that strongly.
Cool. I think at that point now, I think we're going to wrap up this session. Because it seems to be tailing off quite nicely. So until next time, take care.
Take care.